WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Paul Schrader has a new movie called Autofocus. Schrader also wrote the screenplays for the films Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and The Last Temptation of Christ, and directed the films Affliction, American Gigolo, and Hardcore. His new film, Autofocus, had its world premiere last month at the Telluride Film Festival, where Schrader was the subject of a special tribute. Autofocus is about sexual obsession and how it can be fed by the adulation that comes with celebrity. It's based on the true story of a minor celebrity, Bob Crane. He starred in Hogan's Heroes, the 60s sitcom set in the unlikely place of a World War II prisoner of war camp run by the Germans. Here's a scene from the actual sitcom featuring the characters of Sergeant Schultz, Colonel Klink, and the American POW Hogan, played by Bob Crane.
Up, 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 up! Everybody arouse, 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 arouse! You're going to be counted! Everybody up!
Gentlemen! Gentlemen! Sorry to disturb your beauty sleep. This won't take very long. Count them, Schultz.
Yeah, what are you going on? Hey, hey, hey! It's all the excitement.
Ah! Colonel Hogan! Good evening!
Don't you Germans ever knock?
I wanted to keep it a surprise.
It's bad taste waking people up in the middle of the war.
Just a minute, Hogan. The count is not over yet.
All right, get on with it.
What's your rush? You're not going anywhere.
As a matter of fact, I have a date in town.
Oh, really? Who's the lucky girl?
It's not a girl. It's an Eskimo.
Good old Yankee sense of humor.
Right. We're going to laugh all the way to Berlin.
The viewers of Hogan's Heroes didn't know that actor Bob Crane was obsessed with sex. He used his fame to attract women and would often record his adventures with them on early state-of-the-art home video. After Hogan's Heroes ended in 1971, Crane had trouble finding work. He toured the country doing dinner theater. In this scene from Autofocus, Crane is washed up and still trying to impress women with whatever celebrity remains from his Hogan's Heroes days. Sitting at a hotel bar with his eye on a woman, he asks the bartender to switch the TV to the channel showing a Hogan's Heroes rerun. Crane is played by Greg Kinnear.
I'm sorry to bother you. It's just that I was sitting over there and I noticed the TV and I... Well, is that you on the TV? Is that...
Oh, my gosh. That is embarrassing. I didn't even know it was on. I'm Bob Crane.
I know. I thought so.
Yeah.
Bob Crane. Gosh, it's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Oh, Susan.
Susan, all right.
I loved your TV show.
Well, appreciate that. I'm just in town here to do a little bit of theater.
I just wanted to say hi.
Sure. Can I get you something? Another drink? An autograph?
Well,
a nude swim?
Bob.
You know, I'm a real photo nut. And how long are you girls in town?
Bob Crane was beaten to death in his hotel room in 1978. His secret life was uncovered during his murder trial. I spoke with Paul Schrader about directing his new film, Autofocus. What are the parts of Bob Crane's story that most interested you?
There were a number of things that attracted me to the story and to the life of Bob Crane. But at the base of it, it had the power of fiction. And I think that's the starting point for any film biography. If you wouldn't tell this story, if it wasn't about a real person, then you should have second thoughts about telling it at all. And so what I found in Crane's life was a kind of emblematic or totemic American male life, 1965-1980. And a man who was... going through the flip side of female liberation. And I realized he was a character, like many other characters that attracted me, which is essentially a person who wants to do one thing or wants to think he is one thing and behaves in the opposite way. And, you know, this is the heart and soul of psychoanalysis. You know, if we want to be happy, why do we do things that make us unhappy? And so when you run into a character who lives that dilemma large, who comes at you like, you know, two bright headlights of contradiction, that's quite attractive.
Now, you said you see the Bob Crane story as being the flip side of women's liberation. And it seems to me like the women's liberation movement and the whole like sexual revolution of the 60s and early 70s was about, you know, undoing certain repressions, feeling more free, testing certain limits. But with the Bob Crane story, I mean, it's a compulsion. It's something he has no control over. And he may see it as fitting into like the whole like sexual revolution and cultural revolution of the 60s, but what he's got is a serious compulsion. It's a problem that's out of control.
Yeah, but as he says, I'm normal. Sex is normal.
Well, that's what he thinks.
Yeah, that's good for you.
Right.
Which is sort of the delightful conundrum. And since he was living in that climate of liberated feelings all across the board, whether it be, you know, political or sexual or drug or civil rights, he just felt that he was, you know, in the groove. But what was interesting in some ways is that he was that kind of 60s hepcat, that kind of rack pat sort of jazz mentality, who had to put on, you know, beads and bell bottoms to keep scoring chicks, and in the end remained every inch the sexist he ever was.
Right. How do you see the character of Bob Crane connecting with other characters you've made movies about, like Travis in Taxi Driver, or the character in American Gigolo, or the father in Hardcore?
Well, I mean, I think that, like, beginning with Travis, the first script I wrote, or going to Affliction, a more recent movie, you have a person who is, again, acting at cross purposes. And so, you know, Bob Crane is saying, you know, I'm a one-woman man, I'm a family man, and all the while this tail is growing out his backside. Usually, when I make these kind of characters, at some point, at the end, they have a brief moment where they get it, you know, because essentially they're kind of clueless and they're out of sync. And all of a sudden they get it for a moment. Wade Whitehouse in Affliction gets the fact that he has to kill his father. With Bob Crane, he never gets it. He's as clueless on the day he dies as he was on the day we meet him.
Yes, the Bob Crane character in your movie is delusional. He's clueless. He thinks he's kind of happily indulging in sex, not realizing the depth that he's sinking to. But he also narrates the movie. So what are some of the tricky issues you have to deal with when the main character is narrating their own story, but they're kind of totally delusional and clueless about what's really happening to their life?
Well, you've just touched on something that I really love doing, which is the unreliable narrator. Because narration works sort of like intravenous feeding. You're getting nourishment, but you don't taste it. So it seeps into your consciousness. And so, therefore, you assume that your narrator is reliable. Well, when he's unreliable, it creates a nice little frisson between what you're seeing and what you're hearing. And again, it goes back to Taxi Driver, you know, my first script, where you had an unreliable narrator. He was telling you how the world worked, and you were seeing that world, and it wasn't working the way he was telling you it worked. Again, the same here with Mr. Crane. So the narration does a number of things. It helps you expositionally because you're covering 15 years. It also allows you to hear how this man thinks. But it also creates an odd dislocation between what you're hearing and what you're seeing.
In your movie, the character of Bob Crane has a friend named John Carpenter, who's based on a real character in Crane's life. And he's a high-end video salesman and repairman who's in on all the new technology of the 60s. So you have, you know, he's selling these like emerging video tape recorders that you can use at home and video cameras, and this is kind of revolutionary for home recording equipment, and the celebrities, the rich people, are the first people who can afford to buy it. So Crane's really thrilled to get into this. Tell us a little bit about the John Carpenter character and his role in the story.
Carpenter worked for a company called Sonicom at that time, and they were issuing the first VTRs, which was videotape recorder, before there were VCRs. And he kind of freelanced, and he tried to place this equipment in the hands of celebrities, as they often do when they have a new product. And he had sold one to Richard Dawson, who was a gadget freak, and then Dawson was on the same show, Hogan's, as Bob Crane, and he met Bob Crane. Well, they became pals. And Bob's eldest son, you know, told me that he thought John Carpenter was his father's only friend. And they hunted chicks together. And they hunted chicks for a dozen years. And they videotaped and cataloged their exploits. And, you know, they became a kind of symbiotic team. When Crane was murdered, it was the police theory that Carpenter killed him because Crane was trying to break off the relationship. They subsequently took John to trial, and he was acquitted. It was a good fit for them. It was motive, means, and opportunity. Unfortunately, they just didn't have the evidence, and the jury was out about 20 minutes, and he was acquitted.
In a way, I mean, like, celebrity enables people to indulge their appetites in the extreme, as it did for Bob Crane. I'm wondering if that's something you've seen happen a lot in Hollywood, you know, where people indulge appetites that aren't necessarily healthy, at least not at that level.
Well, it's not just Hollywood. It's, you know, it's every community has its star, too.
True, right.
And, you know, most of us, or most of them, you know, who are successful, have pretty strong governors, you know, ways they know that how they have to control their behavior if they are going to maintain this this fame and financial security that they have struggled so hard to achieve. And the irony in Crane's case, you know, he struggles 20-some years to come from nowhere to become a TV star and a hit disc jockey. And then he reaches a point where his behavior is undermining that, and he can't stop.
Paul Schrader, have you thought about a lot about how a sexual drive can get so out of control?
Well, I don't know whether it's sex per se or it's just addictive behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever you have addictive behavior, there's a big displacement going on. Something else is being replaced. You know, it's like the drug addict that says, I used to have a lot of problems, but now I've only got one.
Right.
And also part of his sexual addiction was a kind of cataloging. When he was a family man with his young children, he used to catalog all the games they played. When he became the home porn freak, he cataloged all the women. There was something going on there that was beyond simple, you know, sexual release. It was a kind of obsessive compulsive addictive force that was blotting out or replacing some other insecurity. You know, and that is when, you know, sex becomes problematic, is when it becomes counterproductive to your life. You know, I don't think of someone like Hugh Hefner as being a sex addict because I think that it's an absolutely functional way for him to live. Crane, it didn't work that way, and he was really of that same generation.
My guest is Paul Schrader. He directed the new film Autofocus. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Schrader. He directed the new movie Autofocus. Another interesting thing about Bob Crane is that here he is, a celebrity indulging the sexual, overindulging the sexual appetite, but he's a kind of small-time celebrity. He's kind of like a one-hit wonder. And, you know, at a certain point in his life, he has to go to, like, hotel bars to find women who will recognize him. So it's another really interesting angle of it, that it's not this big celebrity he has. It's kind of small time.
Well, he ended up on the dinner theater circuit, which it was quite lucrative, and it brought him into, you know, all the bedroom communities of America.
And their bedrooms.
Yeah. And he had, you know, a regular routine. You know, they would do the show, and then he would come out afterward and speak to the audience and sort of work them up and tell them where he was going to be. And he had it down.
And in terms of like small-time celebrity, John Carpenter, the video salesman, is always bragging about how he sold video equipment to Tommy Smothers, Dick Rowan, and Elvis. And I love hearing their names all mentioned in the same sentence, like Dick Rowan and Elvis on the same level.
Actually, he also sold it to Jay Silverheels, who played Tonto. And there's a whole kind of Lone Ranger and Tonto motif in the film because Carpenter was half Indian. And, of course, Bob Crane was the masked man.
Right, right. As you explained, because John Carpenter is this video whiz, he hooks up this videotaping system where he and Bob Crane can secretly tape their sexual adventures with the women they bring over. And then they can get aroused again by watching back the tapes. And they often watch the tapes together, and they get aroused together, and they masturbate while watching these tapes. You have a scene in which that happens that's a really interesting scene, and I'd like you to talk about shooting that scene, directing that scene, and what kind of tone you were aiming for in that scene, because you have to strike the right tone.
Yeah, I like that scene. I think it's an absolute hoot. While we were shooting it, I had to sort of bite my tongue to keep from laughing. You know, they're sitting there watching the videos and complaining about women, you know. And Crane says, what is it about women, Carp? You know, they get you and they change their minds. And all the while, you know, they're jerking off and can't quite figure out why women don't understand them. And I just thought this was just delicious in the extreme. And I ended up the scene and fell back and did a kind of tableau, which I sort of like to think of as my Norman Rockwell. You know, the all-American scene, only in this case it's these two home porn pioneers complaining about women and watching their videos.
Instead of drinking beer and watching the football game and complaining about women. Right. So what was it like directing that scene? What did you tell Willem Dafoe and Greg Kinnear before shooting?
Well, as in everything in this particular film, you want to keep underplaying it always because it's the accretion of underplaying that finally, you know, gets under your skin and feels really creepy. And so that you're always understating it. So I think Greg at one point wanted to separate the women talk and the masturbation. And I said, you know, if you do that, then you lose the underplaying. The truly sort of funny, odd thing about it is that, you know, both these activities can happen at the same time and they don't see the connection.
No, that's how clueless they really are. The look of the earlier scenes in the movie in which Bob Crane is still a family man and he hosts a very popular morning radio show in Los Angeles and then starts on Hogan's Heroes, which becomes very successful. The look of those earlier scenes is much different than the look of the later scenes as he descends deeper and deeper into this sexual obsession. Can you talk a little bit about the difference in shooting the earlier scenes and the later scenes?
Well, we came up with an idea called the accretion of clutter, which is that his life just gets messier and messier. And it originally began as an idea for set design. And then we applied it right across the board, color scheme, film stock, camera style, hair, makeup, wardrobe, music, camera technique. And so that by the end of the film, you know, you become aware that you are watching a different movie than you were watching an hour ago. And therefore, there's a kind of incremental shift in all the elements of the film, trying to obscure the exact point where it shifts into another sensibility. You know, much like an addiction itself, you know, an addict can't really tell you the moment it all changed.
And what's different about the camera technique?
Well, it starts out very fluid, you know, dollies and locked off and dollies, and then it moves to Steadicam, and then it moves to a kind of handheld pretending to be steady, and then it moves to a handheld not pretending to be steady, and then it moves into hardcore shaky cam where you're going out of focus and everything.
And what about the visual clutter you were talking about, you know, the theory of clutter? How does the visual clutter change as the movie evolves?
Well, that first just came out of the idea of cords, of TV and electronic cords. And everybody who's had video in the house knows what a mess that technology makes of your house. And so just using that idea and taking it forward so that the neat, well-ordered house of 1965 becomes the video clutter of 1978.
Paul Schrader directed the new movie Autofocus. Here's another scene. Bob Crane and John Carpenter, his sidekick in his sexual adventures, are sitting at a bar. Carpenter is played by Willem Dafoe.
She's a fox. Look at the caboose on her. Day without sex is a day wasted. This place is dead. We still got time to hit strip joint.
And we need to talk.
I don't like the sound of that. We gotta talk. That's what a chick says when she's gonna lower the boom.
Thinking about getting out.
What?
Whole scene.
What scene?
The dinner theater. All the rest.
Excuse me, I'm confused.
The road, the hustling, the broads, the whole thing.
You mean me? I'm part of the whole thing?
Well, without the dinner theater, we'd see each other less. I want to restart my career.
You're kidding, right?
We'll talk more with director Paul Schrader in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Paul Schrader. He wrote the screenplays for Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and The Last Temptation of Christ, and directed the films American Gigolo, Hardcore, and Affliction. His new movie, Autofocus, is based on the secret life of actor Bob Crane, the star of the 60s sitcom Hogan's Heroes. Crane had a sexual obsession and used his celebrity to attract women. Crane is played in the movie by Greg Kinnear. Now, I have to say, Greg Kinnear is very good in the role of Bob Crane. And he's somebody who started off doing, you know, talk soup on the E! Channel, being a kind of smug comic, making fun of television shows. And he's evolved into a really interesting actor. Did you have any doubts at first about his ability to pull this off?
No. When I first got involved with this film, someone mentioned his name to me. And I thought about 5 seconds, and I said, that is a great idea.
Why?
Because he has all the equipment that Bob Crane had when he walks in the door. He has that glib sensibility. He has that smirking, funny, ironic tone. He knows light comedy. These are not easy things to teach an actor. So I had the actor had these. And I had been watching his performances, and I'd seen him grow better, and I felt quite sure that I could take him out in the deep end of the pool. And he would be all right. And I'm comfortable out in the deep end. I'm comfortable out there with an actor in the deep end. And he's comfortable in the shallow end. So it seemed like the best of both worlds, and it actually worked out that way.
In directing the film Autofocus, it's a film about sexuality that's gone out of control. So you have to depict as realistically as you can the sex lives of these main characters. On the other hand, you have to be able to screen it in multiplexes. So what was your approach to figuring out what to show and what not to show?
Well, it's about the birth of home porn, so you got to let the audience know that's what you're doing. The ratings board is rather restrictive at the moment, and I thought I was working within the R, and I wasn't, because I was sort of basing my thing, my take on it, on HBO and on Six Feet Under and The Sopranos, and that's sort of the kind of stuff I was shooting. Well, it turns out you couldn't show Six Feet Under in a multiplex. It wouldn't be rated R. So I had a number of scenes that I had to deal with in that way, and I chose to obscure or pixelate the offending areas, which is, you know, an unfortunate compromise. And when it goes to Europe, you know, the simulated sex will be as it was shot. But when you see it in the multiplex, it will be pixelated. And I left it pixelated so that the viewer would know that, yes, Bob was shooting hardcore at this time. It wasn't cheesecake. And no, we can't show it to you now.
Do you wish that you could?
Well, I mean, it is simulated, and it's not that different than, it was pretty much the same kind of stuff they're showing on Six Feet Under. So I was a little thrown when I realized I couldn't.
Now, there's a scene early on in the movie where Bob Crane meets with a priest. And this is when he's still kind of holding to the fiction of his life. And the priest says, it's not easy to resist temptation. You must remove yourself from the occasion of sin. I thought of two things when the priest says that. One is when he says, it's not easy to resist temptation. I thought of your film, The Last Temptation of Christ, obviously. And then I also thought a little bit about your own life, since you grew up in a fundamentalist family, in a family where even dancing and going to see movies was forbidden. I guess I'm wondering if when you broke away from that, where so much that we would consider ordinary and commonplace was forbidden, if it was ever easy to swing to the other extreme and overindulge in things that had been forbidden.
No, I don't think so for me, because I had a Calvinist background, and that ethic is pretty rigorous, and it's pretty hard to escape. This whole sense that you are put on this earth for a reason, there is a moral certainty. At the end of your life, you will be called into account. Even when you leave that world, and even when you break away from it, those elements still stay with you. You know, you really can't run far away enough to run away from that. So, you know, even though, you know, I became so-called liberated and lived in Los Angeles, my primary drive was the work and to do things that I felt would be worthy of my talents.
You've said that Pauline Kael convinced you to become a film critic instead of a minister, which is what you were originally studying to be. What did she say to you that convinced you?
Well, she just validated, you know, something that was probably pretty obvious from talking to me. No, I was in pre-sim, and I had met her through one of those serendipities of life that changes one's life. And I had come to New York for a summer to see movies, because movies were forbidden and I wanted to know more about them. And after meeting her, she said, you know, you want to be a film critic, and we are going to keep in touch. And we did. She became my mentor, and eventually she got me into UCLA Film School and got me a job as a critic.
My guest is Paul Schrader. He directed the new movie Autofocus. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Schrader. He wrote Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, The Last Temptation of Christ. He directed Blue Collar, American Gigolo, The Comfort of Strangers, Affliction. His new film is called Autofocus, and it's based on the true story of the actor Bob Crane, who starred in the TV sitcom Hogan's Heroes in the 60s and early 70s. And it turned out that he was leading a very kind of obsessive, sordid sexual life. Your first produced screenplay was Taxi Driver, and in the book Schrader on Schrader, in which you're interviewed, and also some of your early work is reprinted, you said that when you were writing Taxi Driver, you were very enamored of guns, you were very suicidal, you were drinking heavily, and you were obsessed with pornography in the way a lonely person is. Can you talk a little bit about that obsession with pornography and how, if at all, it figures into the new movie Autofocus?
Well, I was wandering, and at that time in Los Angeles, where I was living, you know, the Pussycat Theaters were open all night long, and so it was a kind of loner's paradise. And also, it really is such a strong visual world that it kind of is like a narcotic or alcohol. It kind of, you know, blurs and blots out all the other pain in your life. So I think that was really more of the function than any overheated purience.
No, I have to say, you said that you didn't go to extremes after leaving leaving the Calvinist religion, but you must have felt like you were doing something very taboo when you were going to strip clubs.
Well, I don't think anything's taboo.
No, but you came up in a world where that was taboo.
You know, once you leave a closed community, like Grand Rapids, Michigan was at that time, you in a way sort of fall off the edge of the table. The people you've left behind aren't interested in who you've become. And when you return home, you know, they don't ask you where you've been. And they don't pay attention, in my case, to your career. And so it's almost like you've walked through a doorway into another world. You're still bringing your old world with you, but a lot of the reference points are simply gone.
I want to just get back to that quote from the book Schrader on Schrader, where you said that, you know, when you're writing Taxi Driver, among other things, you were very enamored of guns and you were suicidal. You owned a gun then. Was the gun for possible suicide or for self-protection?
I think, again, you're talking about blotting out a certain level of emotional pain. And just the fantasy that you can end your life is a palliative and an anesthetic. So that kind of drifted around in the back of my consciousness for a number of years, in greater and lesser degrees. And then when I got married, and then I had a daughter, I remember quite well, it was, you know, shortly after she was born, I was lying in bed and I realized all the suicidal fantasies were gone. They were just gone now, and I had suddenly been jolted into a reality where I realized how selfish and silly all these fantasies were, and that I could proceed now without them. And I have, although a friend, I told the story to a friend, and he reminded me, he said, "Don't worry, they come back."
Well, isn't that reassuring? That's what friends are for. but I imagine you've used some of those fantasies of your past for characters, or at least used them to help you understand marginal characters.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the secret of the creative life is how to feel at ease with your own embarrassment.
You know? That's interesting.
Yeah, because, you know, we're all in, you know, the dirty laundry business, and we're being paid, you know, to take risks and look silly. You know, some people, like race car drivers, get paid to risk their lives in a more concrete way. We get paid to risk our lives in an emotional way.
Since writing and directing a film is risky business in that respect, do you have to banish the film critic in you when you're working on a movie? You know, because a film critic is very critical, and that kind of criticism can paralyze you while you're in the creative process.
Yeah, absolutely. The analogy I like to draw is that the film critic is like a medical examiner. He gets the cadaver on the table, he opens it up and tries to figure out how it lived or why it died. And the filmmaker is like a pregnant mother who is just simply trying to nourish this thing and trying to make sure that it is not born, stillborn. So that you have to keep the medical examiner out of the delivery room because he will get in there and he will kill that baby.
That's a great analogy. I really like that. Did you ever talk about that with Pauline Kael, your good friend and mentor who was a film critic?
No, I don't think so.
You like a lot of great movies that weren't necessarily commercial successes, and you realize, as a filmmaker and former critic, that a commercial success isn't necessarily the sign of a good movie. How much does commercial success mean to you? Like, if autofocus is not a big box office hit, will that affect your view of the film or not?
Well, Jean-Luc Godard once said, "No great movie is successful for the right reason." And I think that's true. So sometimes these films become successful in fluky ways. I have a pretty good feeling about autofocus. I think that it's going to do really quite well. It wasn't that expensive a film. And so I think it will help me. It's, you know, it's hard to finance films. It gets no easier as you get older, particularly now with the stock market where it is. You know, there aren't many crumbs falling off the table, and there's a lot of scavenger dogs out there going for those crumbs. And so that obviously any commercial success gives you, you know, puts you at the head of the pack. On top of which, I'm off to, in 9 weeks, to shoot my first studio film in 20 years, a prequel to The Exorcist. So perhaps if I don't completely screw that up, it might be possible, you know, for me to end my career standing on my own feet rather than groveling for coins.
Well, Paul Schrader, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Paul Schrader directed the new film Autofocus. It opens this weekend in New York and L.A. and opens nationwide in November.